Welcome to the Divorce Podcast, a podcast that aims to address divorce, separation and co-parenting here in the UK, countering the often sensationalist way it's portrayed in the media, challenging the status quo and driving for reform. On each episode, I'm joined by experts to discuss divorce and separation and co-parenting from different angles and to give their opinions and to debate them. I'm Kate Daly, a relationship counsellor and divorce coach, co-founder of Amicable and host of the Divorce Podcast. In this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Carl Donnelly. Carl is an award-winning stand-up comedian, writer and podcaster. He's been twice nominated for the Edinburgh Comedy Award and appeared on a selection of TV shows such as Mock the Week and Russell Howard's Good News. Carl has travelled the world, having performed at the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal, the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, and the New Zealand Comedy Festival. In short, he's a funny bloke who gets around. He's also divorced, and today I'm going to talk to Carl about comedy and divorce, two words you don't hear often in the same sentence. Welcome, Carl.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks so much for joining us.
No, thanks for having me. I almost feel, when you said I'm joined by experts on divorce, I almost felt like...
Yeah, I saw your face at that point.
It's a backhanded compliment, isn't it? It's not the most complimentary thing to describe someone as.
Oh, you see, well, there's an interesting starting point. I'm going to start with your stand-up, if I may. Your stand-up's personal and you're known for being open and very honest about your mental health. What impact did getting divorced have on your mental health?
Oh, it was massive. I would say, and I mean, obviously, because divorce is packed up in a lot of other things. You know, it coincides with a massive sea change in your life, doesn't it? So, but what I think divorce does is add such a torrid amount of admin to something that is a very tricky time already. So, you know, like the breakup is the biggest thing. And then as the breakup is then sort of still ongoing, because, you know, if you've got married, chances are the relationship has been profound and big enough that you've got to that point. So it's not a breakup of a little 1 year short-lived thing. You know, it's normally a big long-term relationship. So like for me, we've been together for 10 years when we broke up. And like, so you're unpacking 10 years of your life and then suddenly you've got to do loads of admin. So I was sad enough already. And then suddenly you have to sort of get professionals in to tell you, to sort of put on paper everything you did wrong, just to really remind you. So like, I found, as somebody who I would say probably I was always prone to mental health issues. You know, I'd had periods of depression, anxiety, little other weird things. Like I'd had body dysmorphia in my teens. Like I've always been a little bit, you know, skirted around the edges of having quite poor mental health. And, you know, that's my divorce, I reckon, was it all coming to a head, that period of my life, that breakup. It sort of really caused me to have a bit of a meltdown. And then luckily, it also almost was the starting point of me sorting myself out. And I've become a lot healthier since mentally. But yeah, that period was very difficult.
A turning point then, it kind of galvanized something different in you.
Yeah, if I've got, you know, if it's that thing you've got to, if you've got to look at the positives, you know, I think I was just quite happy existing along in quite a sort of poor state of mental health, and it took me almost bottoming out to start really going, right, I need to look at some certain things. I did some therapy, you know, I had a sustained period on antidepressants. I did some other slightly more esoteric things like traveling, and, you know, I went off and I drank ayahuasca tea and I did all these hippie things that I thought might help. And, you know, in the end, I sort of cherry picked all the good things that helped from each one. And also time's actually that's the thing that really patches you up. But you do all these things in the meantime to keep you interested and entertained and learn a few things. But then 5 years has passed and you're suddenly like, oh, I think I'm actually over that now.
So do you think then that your sort of natural disposition made the divorce harder in some ways because of the propensity towards mental health issues?
Yeah, I think in terms of the ruminating on it, and, you know, it's probably part of the reason I do stand up. I am a natural overthinker. I always have been. I think weirdly now I'm much more simple-minded. I do think, as I've got to a point of decluttering, that now I find I'm much happier because I've got much less going on in my head, which some people would see is quite a bad thing. So I often think I'm literally now just sitting there on standby, essentially. I'll be sitting there totally zoned out. There's not a thought in my head. But whereas in the past, it was always rattling around with loads of negative thoughts. And I think, yeah, so that when the breakdown of a marriage happened for me, I was in a bit of a spiral at the time, I think, of, you know, of going through the ringer. And yes, some people would deal with it a lot better than I did. I went off and just went a bit crazy for a few years, really, and was very lucky that I navigated it.
Did you use your comedy then to navigate the divorce? Did it feature in your kind of routines and your stand-up?
Loads, yeah. And again, I was always very diplomatic. Like, I didn't want to air my ex-wife's, you know, personal life. Do you know what I mean? So I always talked about my side of it, and not in terms of like the ins and outs of the relationship breakdown, but in terms of how I was responding to it. And like, so because we actually broke up just before the Edinburgh Fringe in 2013. So I was going up to do a month of a show I'd written, and then we broke up. And we sort of broke up. It was that thing of like, let's have a temporary separation, which very rarely does not lead to a full-time separation. Let's be honest. We kid ourselves, but you know, we'd had temporary separations before that and got back together, and the problems never went away. So I think at some point, one of these temporary separations was going to be the last one. And
well, they just sort of run together, don't they? And the periods in between get shorter and shorter and shorter.
And, you know, we went into this temporary separation in like, I think it was like sort of June 2013. And the Edinburgh Fringe starts at the very start of August. So I had this sort of 5-week period where I'd essentially written this show I was taking to the Fringe, and suddenly like my life had fallen apart. So I went to the Fringe and I sort of hastily rewrote my show to really talk about, look, this is the reality. I wrote a show that's in the guide as being about sort of the funny things that happen to you when you're traveling. And then I said to the audience, basically at the top, just so you know, since that went in the brochure, I've gone through a breakup of a marriage. And then the show was about my current state of affairs and my sort of where my head was at. So it ended up being a really successful show. Like, it was probably my best ever received show at the Fringe, but it was not the most happy month. Like, I was in a real state. I was pretty wild. You know, I reckon I was a little bit on the verge of like a psychotic episode.
But do you think that realism, that the fact that you were so raw, effectively, do you think that's what made it successful? Because people could connect with those
Definitely.
Raw feelings.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think there was a real edge to some of the routines where people could see that I was essentially, you know, probably on the edge of being very upset and very, like, you know, yeah, I was keeping it together, but I reckon there was a real sort of probably quite an exciting thing to watch somebody
talking about something
that is so fresh. It's not somebody who went through a breakup and a year later they've sort of computed it and they've written a show. This was somebody who was talking about it in real time.
And is that comedy?
I mean, well, yeah, I mean, I think I did manage to make it funny. Like, I mean, I don't, you know, in hindsight, I probably couldn't even remember a single routine from that show now. I probably got it somewhere in my bits of paper and scrapbooks and stuff, and I never recorded it, which I'm actually quite happy about. So I don't know if I'd want to listen back to it.
Yeah, but it would be painful.
Yeah, but I do think it was funny. You know, I'm always very wary on stage of even routines that have quite a bit of a personal edge, even something about something sad. I always make sure to undercut everything with quite a silly aside or something. I always make it as easy as possible for the audience to
come
take
back.
It on.
But yeah.
Because I'm not
come back from that dark place. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want people to leave a comedy show crying. I know it's quite a modern thing to do now, is to have this real pathos and at the end, everyone leaves sort of slightly sad. But I think actually I wanted people to laugh throughout and then maybe afterwards be like, I don't think he's all right, actually, when they think about it. But I'd like, in the room, I want them laughing.
But it's so important, isn't it? Because one, very few men talk about these raw emotions and divorce in particular. And two, you just don't get that opportunity to speak in real time about things like this. Because like you say, a lot of people we'll talk about things in a reflective way, you know, once time has passed. But to actually get somebody in the moment, I just wonder if that's in somehow so completely valuable to people.
I think so. I remember doing, when was it? It probably wasn't that show. I reckon it was the show after. The show the year after was when I'd had a bit of time to think on things. And I had gone off and I did the most cliched things. Like I traveled around India for a few months. And like, you know, I did, it was a proper checklist of, right, are you a man in your 30s going through a divorce? And the next year I did a show about, right, this is the year since that last sort of horrible few months where everything has fallen apart, and now this is what I've done to try and get myself back to some level of happiness. And that show in particular, I found a lot of men afterwards would come up to me and sort of say, yeah, I went through something really similar. Like it probably more than any show I've ever done, I had people get in touch after seeing it, men in particular, talking about how, yeah, like they'd also gone through this massive period of quite cliched self, you know, sort of, or navel gazing, I suppose.
Is that what men do instead of talking to each other?
Just DM each other on Twitter and say, oh, well, no, I went through the same thing.
I mean, as in go and behave and do things rather than talk about things.
I think so. But yeah, I think I'm in a weird position where I'm sort of almost contractually obliged to talk about myself from doing comedy. So I think I don't have that. You know, weirdly, I think I've always been quite private. You know, an interesting thing would be after when the breakup happened and everything went bad, and I did stuff on stage where I was talking about the sort of years of problems we'd had in the run up to this, and talked about being on antidepressants and doing couples counseling, all these very personal things. And like I had my best friend come to the show and other friends, and after the show say, like, why did you never tell me any of that when it was happening? Like it took them coming to see me on stage to learn what was actually the reality of that last 5 years.
I've heard you say that you're less filtered on stage than you are on real life. I think there was an interview you did where I kind of thought that's quite an interesting thing. Is that because of your job or because of your personality?
I think personality. Yeah. I do think I feel much freer on stage to just let it out. It's almost like the pressure of having an audience there makes me go like, you know, here's everything I can give you. Whereas in real life, I'm actually quite a quiet, shy, retiring type.
Yeah. And I guess that's why a lot of men probably don't speak about divorce and don't talk to each other about it. I can't imagine you sit in the pub necessarily.
No.
I don't know. Whereas perhaps more women would do that and are more able to reach out for that kind of support network.
I'd say, yeah, in terms of just, you know, you don't want to get into gender stereotypes, but I just do think it's naturally much more of a, you know, I know from just growing up, in a very, you know, I sort of grew up in a working class South London environment where, you know, I've never once talked to my dad about feelings or any of that. So it just wasn't done. So I do think it is just, it goes from generation to generation. We just keep it inside or become a stand-up comedian and then you get an outlet. Yeah. The only two options you've got as a man.
What sort of coping strategies did you use going through this really horrible time? You mentioned that, you know, there's that emotional turmoil where you're unpacking what's gone wrong, you know, on a personal level. And then when it's a divorce in particular, or even I guess if you're cohabiting and you've got to move out or do stuff, there's a shed load of admin to do as well. So how did you cope with that double pressure?
I'd be lying if I said I coped with it well for the first period. You know, I definitely went on quite an extreme period of, you know, being a bit of a party guy. I just went out all the time. You know, and it's almost like a release of stress and years of tension building up in that, you know, because our relationship, you know, we I think it was that thing of we ultimately were better friends than we were a couple, but neither of us could accept that for years, really. And actually, I even think to the point of getting married was probably our attempt to try and fix it, you know, and make it a better relationship than it was. And, you know, so I think I'd always had this built an increasingly sort of probably worrying level of anxiety about the relationship. So when it did ultimately end, which was really sad and really hard and brutal, there was also at the same time this sort of massive rush of the weight off the shoulders that, on one hand, I'm brutally sad and I'm beating myself up constantly about the failure of a marriage. But on the other hand, I was, and it's a horrible way of describing it, but I was free. That's what it sort of felt like. So I went on this quite crazy, probably year, 18 months of being very, you know, unhealthy and sort of my drinking and things like that. But it never veered into anything I think was problematic. It was never like alcoholism. It was genuinely more sort of just a man going crazy for a bit to release some, let off some steam. And so I did, you know, that was that. And during that period, I definitely wasn't coping with it well. I wasn't doing anything healthy to fix myself up. But when that died down, and I, it was almost like coming out, it was almost like getting drunk for a year and then waking up with a hangover and then suddenly going, right, I'm getting my life in order. And that was when I did some therapy, but I moved around because I couldn't find the right person.
That's interesting. Yeah.
I think I always had the awareness that I needed somebody to get me. And, you know, I did a couple of sessions with different ones that were private, actually. And they just basically did that thing I think some counselors do, which is sort of sit there and just make notes and let you talk and hope that you're going to get somewhere. Yeah. And I didn't, you know, because I was actually still quite private and reserved and trying to hide a lot of stuff. And so I sort of moved from one to the other. And then finally, actually, I was at my doctor's and I was, you know, this was when I was still on antidepressants and they referred me for therapy. And I thought it'd be like 6 months to a year. And I was very lucky. It just happened that about a month later, I got a call saying, we're going to send you to this place. It was local. And this therapist was incredible. Her name was Diane. And I think she was exactly what I needed. She was probably a woman in her sort of late 50s. She'd traveled the world. She was like very worldly. She was quite challenging as well. She didn't sort of suffer fools. She wasn't passive. Sometimes I'd say something and almost her tone was like, why would you possibly think that? It was like, and actually, I think she knew that was what I needed. It wasn't a lack of professionalism.
Yeah.
And just working with her for a few months, she just really got me to get a lot out that I would have taken years to otherwise. And so that was a real kickstart to, I think, me working out a lot of stuff.
Do you think that prepared you then for the relationship you're now in some ways?
Yeah, I think so. I think there was, you know, I think I've always been very eager to please people. And I'll always sit back and I think let things get worse rather than address it. You know, that's what I used to be like.
I don't want to sound sexist, but it's such a typical Blake reaction, isn't it? Why rock the boat? Everything's covered.
Sit back,
got somewhere to sleep.
I'll be dead in 50 years and it'll be over.
Yeah.
There is that. I think there is that. I was always very much a traditional man in that sense.
Yeah.
So,
well, that's backed up by divorce figures. 65% of divorces are started by women. So, you know, there is that passive element to overcome. But, you know,
So that was it. I think, you know, I was always just somebody who would not discuss the big issues until it was shouted at me and then we're having an argument. And then I would either clam up and go quiet or I'd react like angrily and then try and storm out essentially. I was very bad at just sitting down and having a genuine conversation about things. And I think that period of therapy and just that period of just being, you know, I'd been in a relationship since I was 21. So I was a different person in my early 30s. I suddenly was much more grown up and I've had a period of not being in a marriage and having this sort of freedom and getting a lot out of my system and letting off all this steam. And I think I just was, by the time, like weirdly, I'd actually, my now wife, which is a terrible way to describe it, but my wife, I think is the actual term.
Monogamy allows you to say my now wife.
Yeah, but we actually met, and this is totally innocent. Like we met, I think, about a month before the end of my marriage. Like we were introduced through friends, and I was down in Australia doing some festival gigs, and basically a friend of a friend I just met this person, and we just got on really well. And we had a bit of a laugh, and we sort of stayed. We became Facebook friends, and we stayed in touch. But that was it. That was genuinely we'd met these sort of kindred spirits, I suppose, but we lived on the other side of the world. There was nothing to it at all other than, oh, that's a nice person I met. And then flash forward like 2 years, whatever, 18 months, and we both happened to be in the same city at the same time for a period of time.
So this is after your Indian revelations
So this would have been, yeah. When I came back from that Australian trip, my marriage was sort of in the, that was when we went into this period of about a 2 month breakup essentially, as things just really fell apart. And then I started seeing my wife, I think it would be probably 18 months after the actual breakup of the marriage, maybe longer, maybe about 20 months was, but the gap between actually the breakup of the marriage and starting to see the person who would become my wife. And yeah, that 18 month period was a real learning curve. That was when I went off and did all these crazy things and
which your now wife is eternally grateful, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think, you know, it was sort of boot camp yeah. stuff, you know, even the extreme stuff that I would never recommend to people, like things like, you know, drinking ayahuasca is a real modern sort of trendy hippie thing to go off and do. And you drink this hallucinogenic drink with a shaman and you work out all your inner demons and shame. But, you know, I did get a lot out of it, actually. And, like, you know, I think some people do it and won't get anything. Some people, it's actually quite dangerous. So it's one of the things that I would not recommend, but I was lucky enough to get some positives from it.
Do you feel a sense of shame from the divorce? It's a common emotion for people.
Well, yes. And also, I think I've always had a sense of shame. I think that's one of the issues I worked out in therapy was I had this real shame in me, like, about everything. Like, and I think it just comes from my family. My mum's a very sort of proud working class Irish woman who was always ashamed of our life. You know, we lived in a council flat in South London, and like, she always felt shame about our not doing better in life. So I think, my mum has a lot of mental health problems and has done my entire life. So I think I soaked up a lot of that. And I think I had a real shame issue. Like, it was a deep thing that I had to get out, which is weird because on stage I can be totally brutally honest and talk about my most shameful experiences. But on stage I've got this weird sort of bulletproof vest on of, oh, I'm the comedian guy, but I never had the ability to actually deal with it off stage.
There's a different level. I guess it's a different level of intimacy, isn't it,
maybe? Yeah. It's also easier to laugh at it than it is to actually get to the bottom of it and deal with it. Yeah.
But did you have a sense of shame specifically about the divorce then, or were you dealing with much more general things, do you think?
I definitely had shame about it. It's not when you actually really get into it, I mean, but it can be. But I felt such a shame at the failure of something of that sort of size, you know,
magnitude.
It's such, you know, it's meant to be. You literally stand up in front of a church. We did it in a church because we were both from Irish Catholic families, and you know, we said in front of a church, and I'm not actually religious really now, you know, I'm a lapsed Catholic, but you say in front of God, as you, I suppose, and a group of people that this is forever, this is until I die. So there was a real sense of shame that we didn't to fulfill that promise, you know. Mm.
What do you say to yourself then to get past that? Because I think for a lot of people that resonates, and people get stuck in the sense of shame and the sense of failure and not wanting to try again. So what do you do to get past it?
Well, I think a time will ultimately get rid of it. I think on the whole, a lot of it is just, you've just got to ride it out until it just dissipates, until it's gone. But, you know, I remember just in therapy, just things like guilt and shame. You know, this Diane, the therapist, was very good at pointing out how useless they were as
wasted
emotions.
Yeah. It's like regret. I always think regret's a completely useless emotion. It's gone.
You get nothing out of it. All you're doing is beating yourself up. You're not, most of the time, you're not actually even going to use that feeling to be productive and work out what to do to make up. If you've done something wrong, if you've done something wrong, ultimately, you can't really make up for it. The other person will forgive you or not. And that was also another thing that I learned through therapy. I had this real desperate need to, basically for my ex-wife to just say to me, it's fine, you know, it just happened and we'll move on. But, you know, because it was quite a bad breakup, it was rude of me to expect that from her or want it from her. It was, again, it was that thing of, we just both got to go our separate ways for a while. And one day we might have a conversation where that does happen, which ultimately did happen. You know, it took probably 5 years or something, or 4 years, but you know, we did meet up for a coffee, and you know, she was quite candid and said we should have broken up years before, like, you know what I mean. And but by then I got to a point where I didn't really need to hear it, but a few years before that I was so desperate to be told that, you know. But then through therapy I learned that to be desperate to hear that and need it to move on is totally pointless. You're wasting your time. You've got to be able to move on without it.
Well, you can't rely on other people giving you that stuff, can you? Because you're not in control of
exactly.
them and their emotions.
Yeah. So I think that was something I had to get over, was my desperate need for affirmation from others, which weirdly, obviously, as a comedian, I think the signs are that I might need that on the whole. But I think in my personal life.
But you said a couple of times as well about this idea that time heals and that, you know, there is a process you go through where naturally it just gets better. And again, you know, for people listening, I think it's really interesting to hear you say that, because when you're in it, it feels like it's always going to be this bad. You're never going to recover. You're never going to get any better. And the awfulness is just going to keep piling on.
Yeah, yeah. It's horrible. I mean, it is. Yeah, you can't convince yourself otherwise. You do think this is going to be how I feel forever. And it isn't how you're going to feel forever. That's the reality. But, you know, yeah, I just had to just fill my time with other things and do things that I felt were productive to work through those feelings. And then it did happen. And I don't know, it might have happened regardless of if I'd done those things, but it's nice to not think that at least I tried to be productive with my time and work on myself and do things.
And things like therapy often speed up those natural healing processes, don't they?
Definitely. But I do think it's something that does need to be, you know, I think people hear the word therapy and think it's one thing, but, you know, I was very lucky to find someone that was very good for me.
Was it luck? You rejected two different therapists.
I suppose.
Quite a hard thing to do. It's not easy to like not go back to a therapist or say, look, I don't want to come anymore. I think that's quite a, you know, as a therapist myself, I think clients find that really very difficult.
Yeah. So, but I do think people some people might go into it thinking that that therapists are all the same. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And actually, I think it should be more, people should be more aware that actually, therapists, they're individuals.
Yeah, you know, exactly,
you're gonna, and if you, sometimes you're just gonna meet one that doesn't click with you, and you're not gonna feel that comfortable to really air your soul. So it's better to just, you know, do one session. If you don't click, just go to another
Keep
one.
Keep moving. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I was lucky; it only took me three, and I found somebody who genuinely, I reckon, was the best person I could have found. She was so good.
And it sounds like the therapy's really kind of set you up for, you know, a new relationship and new way of being together.
Yeah. I think she just worked out that she pointed me in the direction of the questions I should have been asking myself rather than the ones I was dwelling on. She just like pointed out, maybe you expect affirmation too much from people to feel like you're allowed to be you, and certain other ones. And like, she just very quickly just worked those out within a couple of sessions of chatting to me. And she was very good at getting my guard down, you know. Sort of, she'd traveled a lot, so it was always like I'd talk about India or things, and she'd always have been to these places and would lure me in with a little tale of her own, and then suddenly bang, we're there. So it was, I think by the time I'd finished with her, and she was quite like, again, she was so, within a couple of months, she was like, I don't really think you need to see me anymore, I think you're on the right, going in the right direction. She was the one who sort of went, you're all right.
And actually hearing
that from a therapist to go, you know, actually, I think you're sort of working it out. It's a really powerful thing to be told. So by the time I actually started seeing my wife, I felt much more secure to be open about my feelings and actually make sure to discuss something before it ever becomes an issue. That's the secret to a good relationship, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Bring it up. So you're quite young when you got divorced. It's a lot to take on, isn't it, when you're that young, when such a big life event happens. Do you think your age impacted how you dealt with things?
Yeah. Like, I do think it feels like, even though, you know, I suppose 31 is young when you think about life as a whole, but, you know, it doesn't feel that. It feels like you should be a fully fledged grown up. But I do think when you think of the word divorce, yeah, you can't help but imagine a sort of a couple in their mid 40s or 50. The kids have left home and they've suddenly gone like, well, we've got nothing in common. Let's break up. Like, it's sort of, so to be, you know, it was almost, especially nowadays as well, because we are in that era where even getting married in your late 20s feels quite early. So like, I was quite lucky in that for some reason, a lot of my old school friends that I'm still friends with, weirdly, are quite traditional people in their lifestyle. So there was actually a few weddings in that few years. So I think if I'd sort of done what a lot of comedians do, which is when they become comedians, they almost shed their old life and all their friends are comedians. I think I would have probably been one of the first ones to get married, because most comedians have this sort of arrested development problem. But because I'd you know, I didn't feel that young because I'd had friends get married and have kids already. And, you know, so we just felt like it was the all right, a normal time to be getting married. It felt because the marriage only ended up lasting a couple of years, even though we'd been together for a long time. That added to the sort of shame of all, like, it was literally within a couple of years of all my mates coming to my big wedding, and it was great fun, and we're all dancing and laughing. And everyone in between that time, there'd been other weddings, and, you know, and suddenly I was not only the first one, but so far the only one out of all my old mates from school who are married. I was the only and first one to go, oh, also, it's now over. So I didn't tell them for a bit of time. I reckon I sort of mentioned it to my best friend and maybe one or two quietly in the following month or two, but a lot of them didn't find out until it sort of trickled through the group months later when people finally sort of accidentally let it slip. And that came from a sense of shame. And that, yeah, I suppose that's an age thing, you know, because if we were in our 40s and we'd been married for ages, the feeling
that it's sort of more acceptable in a weird way, isn't it?
Yeah, it wouldn't have been such a shock, I think, that you've only been married for 2.5 years and it ends. You know, it was, I felt very sudden, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah, I can imagine. You've talked a little bit before in the past when I've listened to some of your stuff about kind of the nastier side of divorce and the process of involving lawyers and solicitors and having to do all of that side of things. What happened in your experience? What was your experience of going the legal route to get divorced?
I mean, I did not enjoy it. I've already mentioned the fact that it does feel, you know, having to add other people into your breakup already just feels invasive, doesn't it? You know, and if it was just a case of getting them in to sign a few bits of paper, that'd be one thing. But, you know, it is a case of it becomes a competition, doesn't it, between two solicitors, essentially, or lawyers, whatever you'd call them. And with mine in particular, I've felt that they were stirring the pot. You know, I actually, things were sort of going relatively smoothly, and we had broken up, and it was a bad breakup. It was sad, and there was a lot of animosity. But was that because you have to take, somebody has to take fault, and I did take fault. I felt like I do think ultimately the actual end of the relationship was my fault, so I accepted responsibility. But I still thought that was just going to be that. And we'd, you know, get it all sorted, and then we'd down the line maybe be more civil to each other, which did happen. But what actually I felt was there was a shift about 6 months into proceedings where I felt the solicitors from the other side suddenly start going, actually, we think our client is entitled to stuff. And, you know, we didn't own property. I didn't have loads of money in savings or anything, you know.
So you mean when the finances, so you've got the doing the divorce bit, which, as you say, is fairly routine, can be a paperwork bit. And if one of you's prepared to accept the blame, then, you know, you can get through that bit. And then it was when the financial discussions started to happen. That's when things started to get more acrimonious.
Definitely. And I think, and I definitely think it was the legal team more than my ex, you know. And I think they encouraged her to probably sort of go down that route a bit more. Whereas actually, you know, she knew, and as we both knew, it was on paper, like there was nothing to give, you know.
Argue
what I mean?
It wasn't. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it felt like they suddenly tried to create a request for something that wasn't really there. And all it did was sort of add a period of probably 6 months to proceedings, you know, as it sort of went back and forth. And it ended up taking us to actually just chat about it personally, because we hadn't had any contact in that period where it got kind of bad. Because I suddenly sort of dug my heels in a bit and was like, hang on.
Yeah. Well, if someone pushes, you push back, don't you?
Yeah.
You've got that old experiment where someone puts their hand up and pushes your hand and you push straight back.
Yeah.
So,
and up to that point, I thought it was just going to be a real smooth thing of just, it would all get done. And, you know, I know it takes longer than it should. But, you know, if there's no problem, it just takes a while because things just take a while. There's no arguing. And then suddenly that started happening. And I did sort of suddenly think, this is out of order. And so we just had no communication really. And then it wasn't until we actually just met up in person, had a conversation. And then the next day things started moving smoothly again, because all it took was that. And to say to them, look, this isn't going to happen. This is not this isn't on. And suddenly they sort of just went, all right, let's get back to just getting it done.
So when you actually get involved, because when you've got solicitors involved, you're one step removed, aren't you?
Yeah.
So they're fighting a process. You two are standing behind it, not even sometimes totally aware of,
yes,
you know, the manipulation or whatever that's going on, or the positioning that's going on. It's the positioning, isn't it? You know, this is in my client's best interest. Well, this is in my client's best interest.
Yeah.
But when you add that layer of complexity in, you, as you say, you stop that process of you two being able to talk to resolve this.
Definitely. Like, yeah, and if anything, it made it harder for us to communicate. I didn't want to, because I suddenly felt like they were speaking for her. And in turn, I was then judging her based on their letters, essentially. And it's a horrible sort of thing. And, you know, and I think my solicitors were bad as well. Like, I know it sounds horrible, but this is probably an age thing. And I'd never dealt with any solicitors in my life. So I just found my local one. I'd walk past it one day and I went, oh, go. It said, you know, we do divorces essentially in their window. And I went, oh, that'll do. So I just went in and they were really reasonable. And, you know, the person I met was nice. And it turns out they're just, you know, they're a bit of a small affair, you know, they weren't bad or anything. But, you know, I don't think they were the most, I don't know, I don't think they had the clout to, so they could have, maybe a better solicitor could have got things sorted quicker. But I just felt like it felt like the moment it started, it was out of my control. And I just had to sit back and hope for the best. And it ended up getting quite messy. And then finally we took control again and then it was sorted. And suddenly it was just a case of waiting for the final paperwork to come through saying you're no longer married.
Yeah. I guess that's the thing, isn't it? Trying to find a process. I'm not suggesting for one minute you'd ever get divorced again, but, you know, and divorce is often a one-time purchase, isn't it? But if you could go back and tell your younger self getting divorced what you'd want to do differently, I guess it's about trying to keep control of the process and not being sucked into a legal battle.
Yeah, yeah. And also no one knows, like, I don't think, unless you've done it before, but like no one knows what divorce entails. I didn't know it took ages, really. I genuinely thought it was much easier than it was. But I think in the UK, because we do have we don't have no fault divorce really.
If
you're separated for a period of time, you can sort of wait it out, can't you? But then that seems like you're sort of in limbo, I think. Whereas, you know, in other countries, you know, I spend a lot of time down in the Southern Hemisphere and they have no fault divorce and it just feels much more civilized. So, you know, you'd hope down the line at some point they'd change things here. But here, you only learn that once you're going through it and suddenly you're like, well, hang on, it's genuinely got to be, I was the bad one.
Yeah. Well, the law has been passed now, so no-fault divorce will come in April 2022. So not too much longer to wait for people. But it feels like that's been a long time coming when, as you say, people like Australia have had no-fault divorce since the 70s.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, that's what it just feels like. You learn all these quite horrible things and you just get caught up in this vortex of bad paperwork and arguing. And, yeah, I found that really added to that period of time's stress.
And so trying to think about what did you learn having gone through that experience to take into your next relationship?
I think, you know, in terms of actual how to navigate a relationship, I just now know, never sit on a bad feeling and let it get to a point where it's a resentment, isn't it? You know, you want to just get everything out as soon as possible. I'm lucky in that me and my wife are very similar. You know, I think that me and my ex-wife got together young. And then by the end of our 20s, we'd both grown very different to how we were in the start of our 20s. So that was, you know, it was probably only a matter of time before we grew to the point of being so different from when we got together that it was almost like, what's the point of being in a relationship? We're not in the same relationship that we were. Whereas me and my wife, you know, but we were in our, you know, probably early to mid 30s when we met. And I think we both felt much more, right, this is roughly who we are now for until, you know, older. I can't imagine us drastically changing our personalities or lifestyle. Whereas, you know, I'd gone from being a guy working in an office during my first marriage to a comedian who travels the world.
Famous comedian, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think famous would be trading standards might get involved in that. But, you know, it had gone from being a 9-to-5 job and around at the weekends and the evenings. And over our relationship, I was suddenly away at least two weekends a month. I was out in town doing gigs three or four nights a week. I was going off to the Edinburgh Fringe for a whole month in August. Like, it's a lot of strain to put on a relationship, especially when it's a relationship that wasn't like that at the start. You know, with my wife, she's involved in the world. Like, she's an actor and she does other things. She's worked at fringes and festivals all over the world. So she's much more...
She knows the crack. Yeah.
She knows it. We got together both understanding each other's worlds. Yeah. Whereas, yeah. Sadly, me and my ex got together and then I totally just changed my entire existence. And the pressures that put on her, it's almost rude to expect somebody just to be happy about that life change. You know, suddenly their partner is just not around anymore most of the time. So it wasn't fair on her to expect her to just, all right, this is the life now, so get on board.
Yeah. And so given that can't be an untypical experience, people grow, it feels so wrong that we have such a punitive system for, ending a relationship that has run its course. For me, the whole reason we do what we do is to try and create a different way of doing things a way where you can part with respect and dignity and not make it a fight or a huge hemorrhaging of cash.
But the cost is another one. Cost is something that I didn't know how much it would cost. And I'd agreed to pay the cost, both costs, both sides. So, that's also another, every time solicitors would do something else and drag it out longer, I was getting annoyed that it felt horrible and mean to drag this process out longer, but I was paying for the
it's another bill coming.
So it was, I think, when you got in touch about asking if I'd come and chat about it, and I looked at, I looked up your company, it's like that thing of even just keeping costs down makes the stress of a divorce huge. Because I was just looking at the cost of, like, I'm sad and I'm also losing money. It's double sad.
And that, it's not a small amount of money. That amount of money can be, the bedroom that allows both your kids to have their own bedroom, or the garden for your kids, or
because you're starting a new life.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's costly to to move home. It's costly to, we had to put our stuff in storage and work out what we're doing with our life next. And suddenly you're paying storage costs for all the belongings you've managed to amass over a decade. And, and suddenly then you're also paying thousands and thousands of pounds to solicitors to argue with each other. So I did find the financial element of it quite stressful and added to the bleakness of it all.
Well, look, it's fabulous that you've come on to talk about your experience, and, we really appreciate it. So thank you. It's been fantastic talking to you.
I've actually not talked about it for a while. It's true. I've not talked about it for a while. And I do find, anytime I do talk about it now, the time that's passed since, I find it much easier to sort of, I feel like much clearer headed about it when I discuss it now. I feel like every year that passes, you sort of look back at it and it just feels like a period of your life that happened. And
and a narrative that you can reflect on rather than be constructing as you're going. You're that bit away from it, aren't you?
Definitely.
But I think it's been brilliant, and it's great to have a male voice, because it's hard to get, men to talk about this kind of stuff. So thank you.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for doing that. It's been really, really interesting. I really enjoyed it. Where can people find out more about you, Carl?
Just on social media, I suppose. I'm just sort of, I tend to just do stuff on there, do jokes and things on Twitter and Instagram. I do mad stuff on Instagram, like just make coffee and talk nonsense.
And are you touring at the moment?
I'm not massively. Like, I'm basically because, I've been in Australia for a big chunk of the pandemic because we had a baby last year.
Wow, they've let you out.
Yeah, well, it was so weird. We managed to get an exemption for me to go to Australia at the start of the year, because we wanted to spend time with my daughter's grandparents over in Melbourne. And we ended up sort of getting stuck there for a while because we were just going to go for 3 months, because I'd got this 3-month exemption to be allowed in. And then it just got, things sort of travel is very difficult. We cancelled flights. We didn't get back until July in the end. And we left there and everything was fine. And now Australia's sadly in lockdowns and But yeah, so I've just been away. So now I'm back and just starting to get my stuff together and gig. I'm starting to gig quite a lot. But yeah, I've not put in any official tour or anything like that. I didn't go to the Fringe because I was like too worried it would get cancelled last minute. And I think I'm just going to see out until the end of the year, just doing gigs. And then if next year feels like it's going to be normal, I'll start planning as per usual.
Brilliant. Well, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much. And people can check out your social media profiles to find out what you're up to, which is great. And of course, you can find me on Twitter. I'm @Kate_Daly. You can hear about new podcast episodes by following @divorce_podcast. And you can also subscribe to this podcast by visiting thedivorcepodcast.com. Thanks so much for listening. And thank you, Carl, for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks.